Welcome to the 120th episode of Reverse Sweat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
It's 21 years to the day that the Test match between England and the West Indies was abandoned after just 62 balls due to a dangerous pitch. It became widely known as the farce at Sabina Park. Welcome to the podcast that is always happy when things get a little bit farcical.
Was it the Sabina Park pitch that saw the famous abandoned game sort of 10 or so years ago? Or was that somewhere different? Anyway, the West Indies have a bit of a history with some of this, don't they? So in today's podcast, we are not going to be talking about the condition of the pitch, but we are going to be talking about the Under-19 World Cup, about some antics down in South Africa. Talking of antics, Andy's going to be taking us through the Inzamam incident, one of the more curious and slightly unsavoury chapters in the history of international cricket. And we are going to be reviewing the Periodic Table of Cricket by John Stern. As ever, if you enjoy the podcast, please do hop over onto iTunes and leave us a review and leave us a bit of a rating. Everyone's sick of hearing that, but it is hugely important. Now, Andy, I hadn't even known that the Under-19 World Cup was happening. Actually, I think I had sort of vaguely, but you've been following that quite closely.
Well, the only reason I came across it, frankly, was that there was a little bit of attention given to the fact that England failed to make their way out of the group. And I think there was a usual bit of grumbling about, you know,
the future of cricket.
Quite. And on one side, people saying exactly that. Is this a bad sign? And other people saying, look, it's not really an indicator of anything at that stage. It's really about learning and experience. But I was fascinated to see a couple of very unfamiliar names taking part. So Japan and Nigeria have been participating in the Under-19 World Cup. It's incredibly exciting, I think, to see new names competing at the world level. I think there's just, for an old cricket fan, I think there's just a easy joy in seeing, you know, Nigeria versus England, Japan versus Australia. Mm. There's just something kind of wonderfully improbable about it. However, it's an interesting example, I guess, of how the game is and isn't growing, because while it's great to see them there, they've suffered some extremely heavy defeats. And I think it rather gets to this issue of how you go about growing the game. Is participation in these tournaments enough and a good thing in themselves? Or is it, you know, ultimately not worth too much when they get humbled like that? On the flip side, I think it was rather wonderful. Cricket Info did a little feature about the Nigerians and their captain, Sylvester Okpe. And there was the evident joy and pride he had in taking part in the tournament. And also the inspiration he had received from meeting the South African team, and particularly Themba Bavuma. And you think, well, okay, these defeats are not great for anyone's morale, but perhaps it's those other experiences on the side and the pride of being involved at all that sows the seeds for a better future.
Yeah, I've been looking in a completely different context, in a musical context, at how you can create new musical kind of cultures and leaders for parts of, you know, parts of society, actually, rather than different nations that traditionally don't participate in music. And one of the things that is really interesting is looking at the importance of having role models for young people growing up. So the importance, in a cricketing sense, of young people who are, you know, at school and maybe might have an opportunity to play cricket, that often they will only do that if they have examples of cricketers who have gone on to do good things in their lives, if there are people that they want to emulate. We see it in the, you know, playground all the time. Oh, I'm going to be Ricky Ponting. I'm going to be Shane Warne. Maybe that's not your number one role model. But I think that's such an important thing as well here, is that suddenly now kids in Japan and kids in Nigeria have that opportunity to see what success looks like, even if it's getting thrashed at a World Cup. At least there is some representation for themselves that they can imagine as a pathway into the future.
Yes, and I guess the hope as well is that it gets it on the radar of the right people who have power in sports in those countries. So someone in sports administration says, ah, okay, this thing called cricket.
Yeah, the funding and everything.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think it's a topic we've touched on, I guess, a few times before, and it's a really tricky balance. But I guess, very excited to see what comes next for both of those countries. Now, you've been looking at a more established level of the game, and I guess following what has been a sort of a refreshing England triumph away from home. There haven't been many of those recently.
No, there haven't, and it's kind of turned from the disaster tour into the wonder tour in many ways, and a few revelations for England in terms of some, you know, some openers that have that have come to the party, and England will definitely, I think, take heart from this South Africa tour and the series victory that they've had there. There was one moment there, though, that I wanted to kind of raise, because I was interested to get your opinion on it. I was listening on the last day of the third test, and England were well ahead by this point. They entered the last day needing 4 wickets to win the test by an innings, with a whole lot of, you know, runs still in the bank in order to win it by an innings. Joe Root had taken 4 wickets on the day before, and at the beginning of that fifth day, with a huge cushion, sure, he actually brought himself on and bowled from one end for 10 overs, including after the new ball was offered. They were 10 wicketless overs. He didn't take his fifth wicket. He ended up conceding 28 in one over. South Africa's last pair put on 99. England did still win the test comfortably by an innings. But I did wonder about Root's choice at that point. Whether on the one hand he was justified for searching for that fifth wicket, given it was probably his only chance ever to do that in a test match, or was there a kind of slightly bit of a kind of self over team attitude that came from the captain there? For my money, I think that there is absolutely, when you've got a bit of a cushion, there's an opportunity for a part-time bowler to give themselves maybe 1 or 2 overs to get that fifth. But to give yourself 10 and to tie up one end for that long seems a little bit much to me, because if he genuinely believed, either it's because he's searching, you know, he's just saying, I'm searching for my fifth wicket and being blatant about that, in which case 10 overs is a long time to be doing that for. The other side of it is, I wonder whether there was an element where he was saying, look, I took 4 wickets yesterday. I was the pick of the bowlers. He was the pick of the bowlers. He took the majority of the wickets. So therefore, I'm just going to bowl myself, which doesn't necessarily show the greatest faith in his frontline attack on the last day of the test match, if he's saying me, a part-time spinner, is effectively the best option we've got. I don't know, what did you think of that? What was your take on that?
Well, it was this turning track, and obviously Dom Best did well in the first innings. And I guess there's an interesting question about, I mean, I think overwhelmingly everyone would agree with the idea of Joe Root as a part-time off-spinner. But I think it's interesting in some of England's team selection that, you know, because they're very rarely going to play 2 spinners, there's kind of an expectation the moment the pitch starts turning that he will bowl a fair amount, and maybe you start to view yourself as a little bit more than part-time. I wonder if we're being sort of very, very charitable, if you also say, well, it had been a funny old tour for England, and you look at sort of the fitness issues, you know, with losing Archer, losing Anderson, and the issue with maybe thinking I'll give the seamers a day off. You know, you think, actually, I'll keep wheeling away and I won't force them to put in the hard yards today. So maybe that's a more generous interpretation.
You are a much, much more charitable man than I am, possibly. And certainly the, you know, opinion in the column pages and amongst the Twitterati was pretty divided around kind of Root's motivations and whether, you know, once you're at the top level as a captain, just at no point. I mean, can you imagine the Australia team of the early 2000s doing something like that? Or would they just go straight for the jugular and put on their frontline bowlers and kind of finish it off pretty quickly? Because it did end in a bit of a farce, you know, that over that went for 28. You know, it kind of felt as though England could have just really finished that off and made a statement. And instead, it kind of hung on for a little bit longer.
I think the other thing that was a little bit farcical in this was you had the rain. You know, the rain was around, and I think
it would have been embarrassing, wouldn't it, if South Africa had hung on.
Well, and I think, it much reflected on the South Africans that sadly they really didn't put up the fight you may have expected from them, particularly when you know you've got a lot of time to survive, but you know rain's around, you know you might get that little bit of help. It did feel like a real waste, the extent to which wickets were thrown away.
From the archives. Now, Inzamam Al-Haq, surely one of the most colourful cricketers of his generation, a brilliant batsman on his day, but also a man who was never far from controversy. And this episode, Andy is going to be taking us back 23 years to a moment that has become known as the Inzamam incident.
So in 1997, we are at the Toronto Cricket Skating and Curling Club, and Pakistan and India are contesting the Friendship Cup. This ODI series was designed to cash in on Canada's cricket-crazy expat population and seemed to have had success with that. There were good crowds and good turnouts.
And just a quick question. So the Toronto Cricket Skating and Curling Club, did that mean it was kind of the oval was frozen over during the winter in order to create a skating and curling club? I'm probably asking you a question beyond your level of research here. It's just a curious combination of activities there.
So while not an expert on the Toronto Cricket Skating and Curling Club, I guess it is a slightly common theme, isn't it, that the reasonable number of cricket clubs that are cricket clubs and something else. So yes, whether the skating ended up on the middle or elsewhere, it was, yes, like a multi-sport. I mean, who knows? Maybe you could play all three simultaneously to get, you know, give the crowd really their money's
worth.
Cricket on ice.
Anyway, back to 1997. Sorry, my interruption.
So India won the opening series, opening game, and the second took place on the 14th of September. Pakistan are skittled for just 116. Not great entertainment. Lax ground security meant that an Indian fan, Shav Kumar Thind, was allowed in with a megaphone, and he quickly put it to good use. He seems to have had plenty to say to Inzamam, but it's interesting because there are actually a reasonable number of eyewitness accounts that you can find online, and quite a few of the fans who were there note that actually Pakistani youngster Hassan Raza, who was fielding near the boundary for most of the India innings, was the one who got the most of the comments, and he apparently laughed it off and bantered with the crowd. There wasn't any particular incident arising from any of those comments. There was a heavily carbohydrate theme to the Inzamam insults. He was called a fat and rotten potato repeatedly. Now, I've had a sort of bit of a look at this, and I'm very happy to be corrected if someone listening to this knows better, but there doesn't appear to be any particular significance within Pakistani culture around this as an insult that makes it particularly offensive. But anyway, it did not go down well.
Yeah, it's pretty mild, isn't it? I mean, compared to some of the sledging that we hear about kind of nowadays, which often has a kind of vilely, you know, racist or, you know, homophobic slant to it. It actually feels a little slightly pathetic as an insult, really.
Well, I guess, yeah, it's how you feel about your weight, isn't it? It's a pretty clearly directed insult. And as we're to find out, Inzamam clearly does not feel entirely positive.
But he wasn't, because I've watched the video of this, he wasn't actually that large at that stage.
No.
I mean, but compared to later, certainly, compared to later where, you know, he was visibly out of place in any kind of sporting context, he didn't... Anyway, look, it's just one of those quirks of this story is the fact that it's interesting that it got so under his skin.
Yeah, and it always feels like an odd insult in a cricket context, doesn't it? I mean, we've had this recently where Joss Butler in the series made a comment about Vernon Philander's belly.
The size of his bottom behind his belly,
and
yeah.
It's always felt a slightly odd, pointless insult in cricket because actually, you know, if you're bowling or batting wonderfully, the size of your belly does seem rather irrelevant. But yes. The trouble really started, the insults had been flowing, but the trouble really started when Inzamam was sent from the slips to field on the boundary. A little bit odd, because Inzamam wasn't then, and never was, I think, a natural boundary fielder.
He's not a boundary prowler, no.
Yeah, which actually, if you're going to... There are a few sorts of conspiracy theories here, but if you're going to start theorising, perhaps they start right there with that decision. Now, unlike some of the features that we do on From the Archives, where, you know, we're reliant totally on the accounts... written at the time, you feel free to head to YouTube and you can watch this and come to your own view on what exactly happened. It's not perfect because the camera's sort of flashing around, so you don't get the total you don't get sort of beginning to end of the incident perfectly. But from what you can see, Inzamam walks into the crowd, he walks up the stairs and attacks his megaphone-wielding tormentor. He then seems to allow himself to be led away by another fan, and the megaphone-wielding fan, Kumar Thind, chases him down the stairs. At this point, Inzamam somewhat ups the stakes. He picks up a bat left by the boundary rope, more on that later, and attempts to strike the fan with it. As far as I can see, I don't think he ever succeeds. I think he's managed to hit the fan earlier, but exactly, I don't think he ever succeeds in actually hitting him with the bat. Security intervene en masse pretty late. A PA announcement asks fans to stop using megaphones, also pretty late. And to quote one rather unkind Indian TV presenter, the potato had boiled over.
That surely is one of the great quotes in all of cricket.
I know, and I think there's something about having been upset by an insult to then have it kind of repeated and legitimised by a TV journalist is not ideal. Yeah. There's a 40-minute break, but the game is eventually able to conclude. The fact that it was able to finish, we owe a lot to Indian coach Madan Lal, who did a lot of work in calming down the Indian fans. Pakistan didn't really help things, because when Inzamam returned to the pitch, that really riled them up again. I think the expectation was that, I guess, he would either not return or perhaps he'd put a 12th man on. The cricket by this stage feels rather irrelevant, but India cruised to a 7-wicket victory. Inzamam was to later say, I hadn't gone into the stand to have a fist fight with him. I just went to ask him why he was abusing me. He also insisted that Kumar Thind had attacked him and he'd acted only in self-defence.
That seems like an odd for a man who's kind of deliberately left the pitch and waded into the crowd. Self-defence seems like a flimsy argument to make on that basis, I reckon.
Well, I guess you're arguing, I went up there to have a nice civilised chat and then he thumped me. There is a loose argument to it. I think the thing that really undermines this theory of I went in for a chat is this question of the cricket bat. Now, any seasoned cricket spectator would know that, you know, you don't just leave bats hanging around the boundary rope. There's no need for them, particularly. And there is this slightly odd thing that the 12th man seems to have brought it and left it there. And it seems quite possible, and this, I think, adds a rather dark and, you know, almost sinister tone to the whole incident, that Inzamam may have asked for it, which does suggest a worrying degree of premeditation. If you, you know, lose your temper and charge into the crowd, not great. If you think, I'm going to thump that guy with a cricket bat, let me just ask the 12th man to get it for me, that's not great for someone trying to build the case for Inzamam's defence.
Yeah, interesting as well that he didn't take the bat in first time then, you know. Or maybe he did decide to have a quiet little chat, then come back and get the bat. But it just, it is an odd sequence of events. That if he was premeditating, I'm going to thump that guy with the bat, that he didn't just take the bat and wade into the crowd with the bat in the first instance, that he went for that kind of initial nice chat with a cheeky punch.
I guess the one thing you can say, if a cricket batsman is going to attack anyone, then obviously, you know, you want your trusty bat with you.
You do. He's not going to miss.
Sachin Tendulkar tries to play peacemaker after the game, and it feels like that's the obvious answer, isn't it? You send for your great. And he asks the Indian supporter Thind to drop the charges, but Thind initially refuses. He's then arrested by Toronto police, accused of throwing his megaphone at Inzamam. Inzamam is also questioned by the police. At that point, both parties, I think rather sensibly, presumably for both of their sanity, agree to drop charges.
Is there any evidence at all that Thind did throw his megaphone at Inzamam? Because certainly that's not on any of the footage that I've seen.
Well, I mean, I suppose, I think watching the footage, you can see perhaps that Thind raises the megaphone, but perhaps as much to not get thumped by... It's very difficult. Maybe if you really slow the footage down, you can sort of work out what happened. I mean, I don't know. It feels like a very diplomatic thing to do, to sort of give both a ticking off and then both decide to quietly leave it. The cricket authorities obviously did have to take action, although, frankly, not a huge amount of action. Inzamam gets a 2-match ban. I think by any measure, that feels generous. There's oddly a kind of timely comparison for this, which is that 25 years ago this week, Eric Cantona got an 8-month ban for his infamous Kung Fu kick as a Manchester United player playing against Crystal Palace. And that's 2 years before this incident. Mm. So, you know, it's not as if we're talking about totally different eras. Rather extraordinarily, Inzamam was back by the final game of the series and he top scores in a Pakistan win, which suggests that, if anything, the break did him good.
It's interesting to think as well of how we think about the responsibility of players, because you always think that the players should rise above in these circumstances, that whatever they get hurled at them, and that's the basis on which, so, you know, subsequently, and now it is predominantly verbal rather than physical, the altercations between players and the crowd. But I think that's often why players have come down on so hard when these things happen. And we saw it recently with Jos Buttler, actually, in this South Africa series as well. But it feels like this is kind of at the at the beginning of when, you know, players and the press interacted more, players and the crowd interacted more, there wasn't such a divide between the two, and possibly therefore a bit of a turning point in some ways.
I think what's remarkable is it reminds you how calm and composed the vast, vast majority of sportsmen yes. are. I mean, they are in certain situations treated to, you know, pretty heavy abuse, also at a time when they're emotionally kind of very, very fired up. I mean, I think that was it with the Stokes incident recently, wasn't it? That you had someone who'd just been dismissed, was furious about that, then took this abuse, and he, you know, he did say something. And I think it does remind you that another skill on this is another of the many skills of playing sports at the highest level is a considerable degree of self-control. The Review, and for this episode we've been reading The Periodic Table of Cricket by John Stern. It was published in 2016. Stern's a former editor of The Cricketer and now has the wonderful job of editor at large at Wisden. Doesn't everyone want to be editor at large? Far better than mere editor. The Periodic Table is actually a series put out by Ebury Press, and it's so far covered a wide range of subjects, going from cocktails to hip-hop. The idea is that personalities are arranged based on their characteristics. So the result is a kind of series of interestingly grouped mini biographies. I guess for something like this to work, the whole premise is based on the groupings. Were you convinced? Did they make sense in reference to cricket and the personalities they were dealing with?
So the groupings that come out in the book are defenders and pragmatists, stylists and entertainers, mavericks and rebels, aggressors and enforcers, and innovators and pioneers. And on the whole, in a way, this is kind of a bit of a sort of pub game, this book, isn't it? You're not looking to it for too much in the way of facts. That's not to say it's not factual, but you're looking for it as a way of kind of stimulating debate and thought. And on the whole, I think the groupings do work on two fronts, one of which is some of the comparisons between the players that is thrown up by this, I think is really interesting. Usually we group cricketers by era or country or batsman and bowler or teammates. And one of the things that you pulled out actually, which I was amused by, is the Mike Brearley versus Chris Gayle comparison. You know, the idea that actually this bespectacled, cerebral England captain can be directly compared with Chris Gayle, who is introduced in the book with one of his tweets, which is, "If you don't have a strip club at home, you ain't a cricket player."
Which is something that Brearley, funnily enough, never said.
I mean, he might have thought it, but he didn't necessarily say it.
But the funny thing about it is it sort of works in that you sort of think it's mad and you think Stern is kind of trying it on. But actually, you can see there's a case. You know, the idea of them as mavericks works perfectly well, actually.
Yep. And I think that some of the cricketers... One of the things that this book proves is that the cricketers who really are great actually do straddle a few of these different things. I mean, Warne, it's interesting, he puts Warne in the category of aggressors and enforcers, whereas I would have thought that if there is anyone who qualifies as a maverick and rebel, surely it's Shane Warne. But I think one of the things that it just proves is that some of the most complex cricketers actually do go across a few different categories. Now, this idea of kind of a page on each cricketer, how did you find that?
So I think there's an interesting question about what you're trying to do with that page. There's not a huge amount of space. And where I think it works really well is when Stern allows himself to be a writer, frankly, and, you know, to pull out his own personal little pen portrait, or to pick a few, or to be the editor, actually, and pick out a few neat quotes that others have used. And I think those are rather wonderful. And it's one of the reasons why I think we will both, I think, find this as a useful resource going forward, dropping back and looking at players. Where I think it works less well is when you get a long list of stats being reeled off. I think partly because you can glaze over a little bit, but also because, you know, in the age of Crick Info and Wikipedia, this isn't really how the natural way, frankly, that most of us sort of engage with. You know, if we want stats, that is increasingly, I think, for most of us, quite an online thing. You know, you look up the average or thing online. So I think there's an interesting challenge perhaps for a modern book like this that is sort of part fun, part reference book, where to what extent are your readers still looking for that kind of statistical reference side of it?
Yep. I think the other thing is that with all of these cricketers, if you're picking the finest cricketers to have played the game, they all, of course, have a whole list of records and interesting and remarkable statistics against their names. So after a while, you kind of go, oh, here's another person who scored 5 triple centuries in first-class cricket, and here's another person who took 55 wicket hauls, or, you know, something like that. So in a way, those stats come to have a little bit less meaning when there are so many of them with that.
I think it's a wonderful source of anecdotes and quotes. I have no doubt that the two of us will find some great From the Archives ideas in here, because Stern does have a very good eye for, you know, that curious little thing or that curious little story. I enjoyed, I hadn't known this, or maybe I'd known it and forgotten it, Mark Waugh's nickname, Afghan, the Forgotten War, which I thought, you know, credit to the Australians on that. That shows a level of ingenuity that goes a long way behind, you know, beyond the English kind of Swanee and all that, you know.
You
can do more than just add Y to a name. And I also love this from A.B. de Villiers, who I think, you know, is often almost sickeningly described as this multi-talented monster at a young age. I decided when I was 10 that I was going to do something in sport one day. which
understatement of the, yes.
A huge understatement, but I also kind of like the idea of the multi-talented de Villiers sitting down at age 10 and thinking, oh, I'll dominate the world at something.
The other thing that I think is quite interesting about having very short form distilled descriptions of the players is that often you get the contradictions of those players coming through quite strongly. I enjoyed the entry on Jon Snow, the English bowler, which describes in the same paragraph him, you know, hitting batsmen in the face with a ball, I hasten to add, he wasn't doing an Inzi, being warned for intimidatory bowling, being disciplined for barging Sunil Gavaskar, and at the same time this is the man who was the son of a vicar who published volumes of poetry while it was all happening. And there's something about the short form that allows those kinds of anecdotes to come through. I think the other thing is that Stern is very good, as you've kind of referred to it, making sure that he, when he's writing these, that he is bringing out the quirks of, you know, the quirks of the players as well. So I think that's something that's really powerful.
I think you get the feeling, I mean, you've said absolutely this is sort of the foundation of an excellent pub conversation. You get the feeling he's had a huge amount of fun with it as well. You know, presumably he has sat down with his lists and played around and tried these different categories. And I think that comes across, that he's someone who, he's rather enjoyed the challenge. And I think, like all of these lists, you know, it's the same when people do, you know, top 100s of the decade or whatever. You know, you write them as much as a spur to debate and discussion as you ever do to produce anything that can be seen as definitive.
So that is the periodic table of cricket. It does actually have a periodic table fold-out pasted onto the inside cover, which is pretty exciting, frankly. I quite like that. I might rip
more
it out
stick it
on my bedroom wall.
Yeah.
And that is by John Stern. I think it's, you know, the perfect book to keep by the loo. And I mean that as a compliment. That was the 120th episode of Reverse Threat Radio. We will be back in a few weeks. Thank you.